community.
Vibrant people.
A representation of our expanded strength.
Identity crisis.
And inability to be exterminated.
Legacy.
Roots that are established way beyond geographical placement.
Recognizing our combined struggle.
Migrating community.
Bridging gaps.
History. And
I don't know.
Must difference always be polarized, or is there space for the in-between? Welcome, this is Diaspora Diaries, a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse. I'm your host, Awa, and today I am here with Binta Yad.
Hello, hi.
So glad to have you here.
Likewise.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, I can do. So my name is Binta Yad. I am a poet, community organizer, pro bono lawyer, general storyteller, connector, who was raised on Gadigal country in Australia, Sydney, and who is of Senegalese and Italian descent. I've lived in South London for all of my adult life, so claim that proudly too. And my work spans heritage, ancestry, and has a big focus and aim of questioning the systems that we exist within, both internally and systemically, and challenging those to learn from the mistakes and sacrifices of our ancestors with the hopes of building a better world for the future children.
All that and even more. I love that. In today's episode, we discuss binaries and how binaries could or could not, or could be a colonial import. And we think about questions of identity and what identities mean. You've already kind of touched upon it, but there's this one question I ask all of my guests across all of my episodes. Do you consider yourself as part of a diaspora?
Yes, definitely. I am part of two diasporas, although one may not claim me as readily, but I am part of the Senegalese African diaspora, and I'm also part of the Italian diaspora. I'm also part of the Australian diaspora, actually, if we want to be specific with it. I think my cultural ties are more rooted in Australia than they are anywhere else, but I am very much a Senegalese and Italian woman, and those existences hold equal parts.
That's actually super interesting because I am of German and Senegalese heritage.
Yes.
And I would consider myself from the Senegalese diaspora, but yes, I wouldn't consider myself from the German diaspora. I am German.
Yes.
But I wouldn't consider myself from the German
diaspora.
And
you lived in Germany, for a bit?
I did live in Germany for a couple of years.
Interesting.
But I spoke about this with another guest on one of the earliest episodes in season one. Mm. She's French and German, living in Canada. Mm. And she said she doesn't consider herself as part of a diaspora because to her there is an aspect of displacement and forced migration, historical or present day, that she does not relate to. And she wouldn't, for example, intentionally really put herself in certain spaces around French people. She doesn't feel the need to claim some kind of French identity or German identity. And that's how she made sense of not considering herself as part of a diaspora. And I think it's also how I would make sense of why I would consider myself from the Senegalese diaspora, but not necessarily
the German. That's interesting because one of your parents is German.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear what your friend is saying regarding the history of displacement. I think if I was Italian by virtue of like a Senegalese parent immigrating to Italy because of forced or chosen displacement, then that would be different. But given that I have ancestral links and like my mother's like a white Italian woman in the same way that your parent is white German, how do you reconcile that part of your identity given that it isn't rooted in displacement? It is actually links, like by all means, are like indigenous German.
I guess that's why I said I am German.
Mm.
But I think, to me, I naturally associate diaspora to community and being in certain, around certain people, really.
Yeah.
And I would never, ever, ever think of trying to go to German diaspora meetings in London, for example. Whereas I would try and go into Senegalese spaces in London.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that's where I draw the line.
That's interesting.
So it's not that I don't recognize it. It's just it takes up a different place in my identity and my like personhood, I would say.
So is now I'm asking all the questions. We flipped the that's script. Right. So for you, does the definition of diaspora sit with those from whom the culture originates? So because the reason that I would say I'm part of the Italian diaspora, but they wouldn't necessarily claim me as being part of the diaspora, is because I know if like there was a lot of Italian people would not look at me and say, yeah, she's obviously of the Italian diaspora, but it's not for them to say, it's my ancestry and therefore it is for me to claim, is how I perceive it. But I'm curious for you, who gets to decide who is part of a diaspora?
I guess there's no response really. To me, diaspora relates to history and how history, like the history of colonization also has played out and how people have forcibly been displaced in the past. And even if they're not forcibly displaced nowadays, their migration is a result of a colonial history.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the remnants of empires, right? Yeah. And I think that's where I would differentiate.
Interesting.
I do think diaspora is related to race. And I think...
Interesting, yeah.
Race takes shape in so many different forms. And we spoke about it in like other episodes. And we'll probably have so many others on the topic. But to me, there is an aspect of racialization in the constitutional development or shaping of diasporas.
Yeah, I can see that. I can understand why you would come to that conclusion. And I think it is largely a racialized term anyway. And I think I used to conceive of diaspora in a very similar way, but kind of reshaped my thinking around it when I started looking at the internal like reproduction of colonial politics that you... Well, it's not even the internal reproduction of colonial politics, but, you know, a lot of scholars say that the colonial practices that we witnessed happening across the global south were incubated at home. So before, you know, Kenyans were being subdued by the British, that stuff was happening to British people or to Irish people, right, to people who are much more local. And so with my history as an Italian woman, my family is from the south, or we feel most connected to Calabria, which is literally the soul of the boot, which is completely barren. Everyone has had to leave. There is no work there. It's like an economic wasteland. It's half run by like the mafia. There's a huge amount of corruption. And that's all symptomatic of the treatment that the southern Italians have gotten from the northerners. Like, there's always been a divide between the north and the south of Italy historically, and so a lot of those kind of, you know, Italy wasn't a strong colonial power, but they definitely had the makings to be, and they exercised a lot of that that inequality that they would have injected into any African country that they managed to get their hands on had they not been kicked out of them. They injected that into the south. And so the reason that all this, that southern Italy is empty now, is not because people just got sick of the beautiful mountains and the beaches and the amazing food and culture. It's because they had to leave. So it's that kind of forced displacement that we're speaking about. That's not necessarily someone pushing you out of the country, but it's giving you no other doors to go through other than onto the boat. So my family ended up in Australia through having to leave, and everyone, all of my grandfather's siblings, all of them, I think, left the village that they're from, left their dad alone there and their mom as well. Four of them went to Australia, one of them moved up north, one of them moved to Canada, but like all of them left, and none of them have been back. The last one's been back, was back like 7 years ago most recently, and then that's it. So there's like a history of diaspora there that I think exists for those people. But I definitely don't think that they're necessarily like the main people we think about when we think of diaspora.
That example is really interesting. I like how you related it to your, like, literally heart-to-heart experience with diaspora. The historical political separation between North Italy and Southern Italy was racialized, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is the same in Britain, as you said, with Irish people. But before Irish people, vagrants were racialized. And I think this is something that is commonly misunderstood about how racism works and how racialization takes shape, because it does not need melanin, unfortunately. It definitely needs marker, social marker, physical markers, but it does not need melanin per se. Mm-hmm. And I think, very rightly, we speak about the colonization of Africa and the Atlantic slave trade as, like, such an important and potent example of racism, institutional racism, and structural and economical racism. But there's so many other layers and ways in which racialization takes shape.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up and clarifying. You wrote an article called Homophobia in Sub-Saharan Africa, The Bastard Child of the West.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit more about, like, the background of what triggered that article? It was, I think, written 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, in 2023?
Yes, it was. And it was a kind of condensation of a piece that I had written in my final year at uni around the colonial import that was homophobia and a challenging of this narrative that religious leaders and political leaders in Africa will often invoke, which is that it is, quote unquote, un-African to promote or be part of the LGBTQ community, to be fluid in gender roles, to be an opposer or a non-subscriber to the heteronormative ways of living that we have become accustomed to. So the piece posits and goes through the reasons why it is actually un-African to be homophobic. It is un-African to overly govern what people do in their private lives, to uphold these really stringent gender binaries and gender roles, and that those are all colonial imports that came through the British, the French, the Portuguese, the Spanish, but were not heavily reflected in pre-colonial sub-Saharan Africa. So with the changing ways of being in the metropole, whether that's the UK, whether it's France, Portugal, Spain, these societies shifting towards a less heteronormative way of living, or at least more acceptance for people who are gay or who are trans or who don't fit squarely into these heteronormative roles and norms in the way that they used to. Africa has now been positioned as this really backwards, uncivilized, barbaric place, because I think like 31 of the 54 states in Africa still criminalize homosexuality. And that's not to say it's not wrong. I completely oppose any state governing over what people do with their private lives. But those laws were religious, but also colonial relics. And so that's what the article was about.
The article is particularly timely today with Senegal's increasing criminalization of homosexuality. The new laws are just,
you know how bored you have to be to legislate on a law that already, it's already a crime, and you've gone and increased the penalty.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like, obviously, in the past years, it's just gotten worse, unfortunately, across the continent. I'd say, like, generally, there's been increases in many different places, many different countries. And now with that happening in Senegal, it just like raises the question of like, why is it so important and why is it so present? And I think one thing that you mentioned in your article that I found particularly interesting is how defining differences in terms of binaries is such a Western tradition and way of approaching life, really. And I think there's this tendency in loads of African countries to kind of push Western models of politics, and I think that involves categorization at the level of the nation state. We see it also with how identities are policed and how citizenship is increased and you need to identify different people and differentiate who's from what region, who's mm-hmm. from what country, who's what gender. Do you want to tell me a bit more about this idea of binaries?
Yeah, I think the West has long found grounding in defining binaries in a way that sub-Saharan pre-colonial African societies didn't need to. The way of being was not largely determined by these kind of social antecedents that the West use to kind of create these like social stratifications and these delineations between man, woman, straight, gay, rich, poor, all of these different ways of kind of cutting up a society and thereby creating more division. And so in pre-colonial sub-Saharan societies, there was a huge amount of, and I speak in generalizations, like it's important to note with everything that I say that these societies were still largely patriarchal. I think sometimes we romanticize pre-colonial Africa as if it was this, you know, great, perfect place and the West came and ruined it. It was still largely patriarchal. The gender binary did exist, but what wasn't as prevalent were the social antecedents that were linked to these genders. So being a woman did not mean that you couldn't be king. At the beginning of colonization, in the early colonial period, Nigeria had a female king. Her name was King Ahebi Ugbabe, and she was king of Nigeria in the early colonial period. Everyone knows about like the Dahomey warriors that the movie Woman King was based on. You had female husbands in southern Sudan and I think it was in Kenya as well, modern day Kenya. These women who would essentially come in and become the quote-unquote husband of a younger woman, not for any romantic or sexual reasons, but to preserve the bloodline. And so they would have a man come in essentially as a sperm donor, and the two women would raise the child, and that would continue the lineage. So what a woman could do, they were very much present in the highest stratuses of society and in, you know, the political sphere and things like that. What a woman could do was not as restricted as it then became during the colonial period. And the same applies with sexuality. Again, the statement isn't to say that being gay was never an issue and that gay people were never persecuted in these societies, but there was a much, much more ubiquitous and general sense of either acceptance, in some cases praise, and tolerance at the very, very least. I think about 40 pre-colonial sub-Saharan African societies had documented gay relationships, homosexual relationships, and it just was. And the West came in and couldn't fit these colonies into the social frameworks that they had built up back home. And they, you know, anthropologists from Britain largely, but from Europe, spoke of the sub-Saharan African ways of navigating both the gender and sexuality question as abhorrent, uncivilized, unnatural. They called them sodomites and fetishizers and these really like horrible names because they couldn't fit them into the mold that they had created. So they just forced them into the mold is what happened.
Why do you specify sub-Saharan Africa? Does it have like a specific... I feel like we tend to differentiate sub-Saharan Africa and North Africa, which often is also something that serves Western interests. This differentiating literally on grounds of melanin, literally like Black Africa, essentially, and Arab quotation Africa, marks, Africa. So is there a reason?
There isn't a reason per se. It was more for the purposes of finding societal trends that I felt were more applicable on a wider scale. Because yes, there is definitely a distinction that is heavily peddled by the West between North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that primarily lends itself to create a racial divide within the continent that is not only inaccurate because there are black-skinned people in all of the North African countries who are indigenous to that land, but it also creates a huge amount of division across the continent. But that being said, I felt that when I was writing the essay that this article is based on, that the cultural trends were more kind of similar. in the sub-Saharan African regions, and therefore I could like extrapolate the conclusions I was coming to. I looked at this through the lens of colonization and primarily the Christian missions, whereas in North Africa, it was primarily Islam that had already made its way through. And so those are two completely different, one, time periods, and also two ways of a society being changed. Islam had made its way to North Africa centuries before the Christian missions arrived. And so the changes that I'm looking at in the pre-colonial era in sub-Saharan Africa had likely already occurred in North Africa and in some parts of West Africa as well, and East. But yeah, those were the main reasons. It was primarily just for practical reasons, and no, I have no beef with North Africa. They can join the party too.
I was going to say, I think there's many examples in North Africa of very similar dynamics where it's, I guess the repression comes from different places as well. As you said, also with the influence of the Middle East onto North Africa.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely different influences that impact how it eventually played out and how like identities and LGBTQ people can, you know, express themselves and be really.
Yes.
But yeah, I thought that was an important notice 100%. Because I think even unconsciously we tend to just say sub-Saharan Africa
Absolutely.
Just to kind of talk about real Africa in quotation marks or stuff like that.
I think if I were to rewrite the essay today, it would just be all of Africa.
Oh, is
100%. And okay. My knowledge of North Africa has expanded massively since I've traveled there. That's the most of Africa I've visited is actually in North Africa. And it changes a lot because when you were raised within the West, you were also peddled the same narratives that are being pushed. And so there was that divide in my mind, I'm sure, at the time that I was writing that was like, okay, well, North Africa's over there. And like, that's a different essay that I can write and a different topic. But it is ultimately the same continent, the same colonizers, and the same landmass, you know?
Yeah, and also very much like the same people kind of. If you want to put
there are continuations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you want to put Africans all in the same bag, then there are enough Africans. They belong there. They belong there, absolutely. The reason why I found your emphasis on the binary and like reading the binary as like a Western tradition so interesting is because this binary has been imposed onto African societies in so many different ways.
Mm.
And Mahmoud Mamdani actually talks about tribes and how tribes have been constructed and crystallized through colonial administration, and that like for colonial administrators to deal with, literally, like to deal with people in Africa, the best technique was to make sure that they're in very specific groups and that these specific groups have very specific leaders, very specific customs.
Talents.
That are not meant to develop.
Mm.
So Mamdani talks about tribalism as reified ethnicity. So it's kind of like this, very much this crystallization of ethnicity. And I remember growing up, I've always been very confused in Senegal. I don't know if you have the similar experience, but I've always been very confused by like different ethnicities in Senegal.
Mm.
So for example, I've always been told that Lebu in Senegal, Lebu people are kind of like Wolof people, but then also they're not the same, but also they speak the same language, but also it sounds a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been like, well, but why are they different then? But also, fair enough. And same with Fulani people.
Yeah.
Fulani people and Tukulor in Senegal, same, but also a bit different.
Yeah.
And I think reading this article, it's called What is a Tribe by Mamdani, I was like, this actually makes sense because if tribes are actually constructed, there's many differences that seem so important nowadays that you can really see the process of like crystallization and how like obviously nowadays people claim their ethnicities and their tribes so much. And it's like they've developed in different ways. And I think we can't reduce it to the same thing because it's not nowadays.
Yeah.
But I think this idea of making sure that groups are differentiated, that you've also explained in the case of homophobia and gendered identities and sexuality, how this making sure that every category is one category and not the other. Mamdani also talks about, I quote, if a settler was modern, the native was not. If the settler was defined by history, the native was defined by geography. If modern politics were defined by legislation and sanction, those of the native were defined by habitual observance. So it's always like making sure.
Yes, we're never on the same side of the coin. Absolutely.
I don't know. This make me reflect on identity itself in diaspora. I don't know. I was wondering, like, how, I guess I've come to terms with the fact that identities are fluid, right? And I think I actually spoke to my sister recently. She was giving me feedback on one of my episodes, and she said sometimes I use words that are like so natural for me because I've been in the social sciences for some time now, such as, for example, negotiating identities. And she was like, it's not clear to anybody what negotiating an identity is. And I was like, well, actually, yeah, I would need to explain it. And what I mean by negotiating identities is that I am one and the other, and also not quite one and not quite the other. So it's like I'm in this in-between space.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, I also claim one and I also claim the other, and I claim both at the same time, and sometimes I don't claim any.
Yes.
And I think this is what I mean by negotiating identities. How does it come up for you?
That is such a loaded question. Everything you just said is so interesting. Going back to what you said about the tribes and tribalism, I think that it is really interesting, and I need to explore that concept more because I haven't really sat with the idea that not only could our borders be a colonial construct, but our tribes could be as well. And as a Senegalese person, there is a huge, even as an Italian person, there is a huge amount of emphasis of where within that country you come from. Like, I'm not just Italian, I'm Calabrese. I'm not just Senegalese, I'm Lebu, or I'm this, or I'm that. And when Senegalese people meet you, they ask you as well. They always think you're Pearl because you're mixed race, but like that's besides the point.
For context, Fulani people are usually
light-skinned, but there's a huge emphasis on that, and it does create a sense of belonging that I've always felt isn't tied to colony in the same way that, you know, having like a map of Senegal has never sat right for me. Like, you know, those like necklaces of like the map of the country, because it's like they didn't draw those borders like a white man from France did just randomly on vibes, like with no consideration for the communities that existed there, which is why you've got Fulani people in Senegal, but you've also got them in the neighboring countries as well.
Everywhere, all over. Well, I guess for Fulani people, it's even more complicated because Fulani people have historically been nomadic people. But say, Lebu, there are Lebu people in Mauritania as well.
Yes, there are. Absolutely.
Same thing.
Absolutely.
Whereas Lebu people are people that are quite sedentary.
Yes.
Because historically they have been fishermen.
Yes.
Fisher people.
Yeah, fishermen. Fish people.
Fish people.
All of them.
Exactly.
So I think that's a really interesting notion, and it kind of ties in well with what you were saying, or what Mamdani says about the colonial powers always positioning themselves on the opposite side of the spectrum to wherever the colony sits. And this idea that if the West has history, then the global South has geography, which makes me think of when Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, said, like, Africa has no history. And you think, how can a man who's been to Sciences Po, who's led one of the richest countries in the world, say that one of the largest continents on the planet, one of the oldest continents on the planet and resource-rich continents on the planet, has no history?
Isn't it the oldest even?
Yeah. I didn't want to say the because I don't know for sure. And I don't want the geologists coming for my neck. But I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah.
Right? And it's definitely the most resource rich and one of the most historically rich, just by virtue of the huge amount of different cultures, ethnicities and indigenous tribes that exist there. But I do think that to answer your question about identity, like the term negotiating identity is absolutely something you wouldn't have to explain to me because I'm a chief in that. And I completely understand what it means. I think it is a quite particular experience for one, mixed race people. And I know people hate it when mixed race people talk about being mixed race, but it can be a bit tough and a bit confusing. There's also that, but then there's the being mixed race, but also not being raised in the country that either of your ancestral heritages, for lack of a better way of putting it, relate to. So for me, that's being Senegalese and being Italian, but having been raised in Australia and having gone to a French school. So I'm spending 8 hours a day in like a very French environment. So by all means, I was also like very much tied to French culture, and I have a link to French culture and French people and all of that stuff. And there isn't enough space in a human consciousness, I think, to hold all of those identities at one. Like, it often feels like it's putty falling out of your hands and you have to pick which one you're going to prioritize. And so when I'm, you know, in this era of my life, traveling through Italy, meeting like family that I've never met before, I'm very much in tune with my Italian side. But as a result, my Senegalese side takes a hit and my links to Australia kind of take a hit. I don't think that it's helpful for me anyways to try and conceive of my identity as a quantifiable thing. It feels too difficult and it makes it feel like I'm doing it wrong when really I just am. So I completely appreciate the idea of identity. And it was once like a really grounding concept for me to be able to be like, this is my identity. I'm a black woman, you know, like every 16-year-old black woman goes through that phase.
Absolutely.
And now I'm like on the opposite side where I'm like, yes, I am a black woman, but that isn't really my identity. Like, to summarize myself up solely as a black woman, I think is doing a great injustice to everything about me that is, one, more important to who I am and why I am the way that I am, but also it's like within my control. So yeah, I think identity is important, but I do think that my experience with it is that I've gotten to a place now where it doesn't serve me as much as it once did when I was trying to find myself as like that young 16-year-old.
What about diaspora then? Because I feel like I'm in a place where diaspora serves me a lot.
Yeah.
But I'm also aware of its limits. And I feel like maybe it will only get me so far.
And I think it will only get you so far, if I'm being completely honest. I think the idea of diaspora to me is the same idea that we often experience with the romanticization, if that's the word, of like our homelands, in air quotes. So like Senegal, for example, where you romanticize this connection to the land and to its people. And then you go there and you realize there are some people here that I like. There are some people here I do not rock with, don't want to chat to. Just like any social landscape that you find yourself in, there is no one thing that connects you with in identity with everyone else that makes them guaranteed to be a person that is safe to be around, good to be around, kind to be around. You can apply that to being from a country. You can apply that to the diaspora. You can apply that from being from a faith. There is no identity marker that I can think of where I can say 100% everyone who has this identity marker, we're brethren from jump. There are always going to be, you know, unpleasant characters. There are always going to be humans that you just don't gel with. And so I think with the concept of diaspora and diaspora being a safe place, like I completely get that and I relate to it heavily. But I don't think it's diaspora in and of itself that is that safe space for you. It's you meeting people who you connect with on a level because you have some similar experiences by virtue of being from the same place, but also because you have other things in common that go beyond the land that you come from. And so I think that diaspora is definitely like a good starting point, the same way if you're a Muslim, meeting other Muslims is always a great starting point, but it's not a guarantee that that is your person and that you're going to find home in that space.
And I think that's where cultural identities always land us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it's been so interesting for me to study cultural identities and race and racialization, in that, to circle back to what we said in the very beginning, when we spoke about difference, is that when you have these very fixed categories, you always idealize the category you consider yourself part of,
yeah.
or in some cases, even the one you're not part of. But there's yeah. always a thing of idealizing a specific group.
Yeah.
And that's what also pushes very, very sharp. Like, for example, nowadays in Europe, especially in the UK, we have like very, very strong anti-immigration sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this idealization of us and the outsiders. Mm-hmm. And if the outsiders were not here, I would feel safe at mm-hmm. home. I would feel safe in my country.
Mm.
And that, as you explained it so well, completely neglects and dismisses and closes its eyes on mm-hmm. the fact that you can feel unsafe around people that are the same as you, in mm-hmm. quotation marks again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always categorizing to kind of give yourself a sense of you know what's around you yeah. when really you never yeah. know.
I think it's that like fundamental, like biological thing that people always speak about that we fear as humans. We just fear the unknown. And so that's why we find it sometimes safer to remain in unsafe situations that are familiar to us than we do to step out and seek out something better. And I think with, you know, all of the anti-immigration rhetoric that is happening across the West at the moment, and these like far-right populist movements and things like that, the people who are leading those movements are preying on the disenfranchisement and the dispossession that everyone is experiencing now, not just Black people, not just Asian people, not just Muslims, not just Jewish people. Everyone in the West feels dispossessed and they feel disenfranchised, except for the Epstein class, frankly. But they're also probably on their toes right now because, like, they've been outed. You know what I mean? No one's feeling safe right now. They've been outed, caught in 4K. No one feels safe right now. And everyone feels safer when they have someone or something to blame for their lack of safety. And immigrants, gay people, Muslims are the easiest people to target because they're a big, unfamiliar group that do not align with the values of a country. And that's where you can direct your hatred. But I've had conversations with anti-immigration believers, let's call them that. If I put them all in a room, they would not get along because they're vastly different people. Some of them are very well-spoken, highly educated. Their reasons for being against immigration are like shrouded in this sense of like intellectualism, but they're ultimately the same reasons that, you know, old Bob from the corner hates the immigrants. Like fundamentally, it's the same reason. But they, in the same space, would not like each other because there is class difference there, because they don't speak the same Queen's English, because they eat different food, because they come from different parts of this island that we call the UK. You cannot fragment someone's identity so finely that you can guarantee that you will get along with them just because you share parts of identity. And I think that what identity politics has done, both on the left side of the spectrum and on the right side of the spectrum, is it has almost made all of us into monoliths of different things. And it has removed the humanity from being a human being who lives among other human beings. You're typecast from the second you step out the house. And yes, that's always been the case to a degree. But now it is so much more. Sometimes it's in a positive way. Sometimes it's in a negative way. You're pulled in 17 different directions based on the identities you're presenting on any given day. And I just find it massively unhelpful. And it creates a barrier to conversation, which is ultimately the way to develop as a society, to evolve to a better, more understanding place, is to converse with one another. And the identity politics keep us from doing so in so many different ways. I don't know how to get out of it, but it's where we are. It's a really, I think, difficult conversation. And I'm sure there are people who are listening to this who will feel very strongly that identity is really important and that there is one side of the political spectrum that's weaponizing identity, and that's why it's creating issues. I think that identity is different things for different people. And again, like, even us trying to identify what identity is kind of like this self-fulfilling prophecy, because it means different things for different people and people get different things from it. And I think the ultimate answer to like all of this is that there's no clear-cut answer, and it's very much dependent on the human in front of you and having the conversation and learning is really the only way that you can kind of get to a place of reconcile.
And as we discussed earlier, I think we can also admit and recognize that it does serve in some places to some extent.
Yeah.
I think it's just the holding on to it as an ultimate truth that is immovable, that is not necessarily productive. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it.
If you have any comments or if you agree, if you disagree, any thoughts, we'd love to hear from you. This was Diaspora Diaries, a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse. You can find us on Instagram at Diaspora X Diaries.